you hit the pavement?
I already answered that damn question.
Judge,
says Tommy belatedly. I sustain the objection, and Hobie retreats to his notes to seek another subject, once again short of success. Naturally, I've gotten the point. But it baffles me, as it has when Hobie's prowled this ground before. What earthly good does it do Niall, even if June rather than Edgar was the target?
Senator Edgar, says Hobie. Let's talk about him. You had one meeting with the senator, is that your testimony?
Seem like one.
Seems like?
One or more than one.
In my lid, man, you know I got one.
It could be more?
Cor shirks it off. Hobie fixes him with a look, but decides, after an instant's reflection, not to pursue it.
Now, hardcore to you, to T-Rock, this idea of getting Cannell out of prison, that was very important, wasn't it?
Down for mine, man, he says. Stomp down. The credo, the gang, he means. Everything for the gang. And that's why you agreed to meet with the senator, am I right? Because getting Cannell out, that's a thing with you, right?
You with it, cuz, he answers, and adds a quick, simpering smile, mocking Hobie for trying to take up his lingo.
And you told us, I believe, that when you found Senator Edgar had this idea that BSD could become a political organization, you were real angry. Deep.
Man, what he was stressing, man, that shit ain't real.
Hobie nods, mulling as he strolls. Then he turns back abruptly and asks in a smaller voice.
So why do you think Senator Edgar was coming down there?
Cor, for an instant, is dead silent. I see him look to Ayers.
Niall saying get with his daddy, that's all.
That's all?
Let's set the scene, Cor. We got two gangbangers, top-rank black men, both convicted felons, right? And we have an important white politician, chairman of the Senate Committee on Criminal Justice, who drives all the way down to the north end of DuSable and climbs in the back of a limousine with the likes of you all, knowing you want nothing more in the world than to get your homie, Cannell, out of Rudyard Penitentiary. Now I ask you again, hardcore. What did you think he was coming for? What did you think he was going to get out of this?
Cor stares, motionless. Feral. Hobie's finally got him.
Huh? Asks Hobie. You and T-Rock had this one checked out, didn't you?
Cor just shakes his head.
You went there thinking you were going to bribe Senator Edgar, didn't you?
Ayers unfurls his lanky form from his folding chair and raises his hand tentatively.
Judge, he says, I have to be heard.
Suddenly, in one of those light switch moments, it's clear what Jackson's doing here. He's not just protecting Hardcore, he's looking after T-Rock, Cannell, his entire client base in BSD. I wave Ayers to his seat, and Hobie asks me to have the court reporter read the question back.
No way, says Cor. You trippin'.
Hobie's nostrils flare in a sudden disbelieving exhalation. It's the first moment in which I know for certain Hardcore has been caught lying. Cor and Ayers have covered this one. If Hardcore acknowledged a conspiracy to commit bribery, T-Rock's supervised release would be in jeopardy. Worse, Cor would have dined out his own. Not the way to commence a 10-year stay at Rudyard.
So, are you telling us, Hardcore, that you never offered or received any money directly or indirectly through Senator Edgar? Is that what you're saying? Do you understand what I'm asking? Nigga, I understand you fine.
Hobie stands with paralytic stillness. The sole movement, an involuntary one, is the tip of his tongue, sneaking forth between his teeth. The word, of course. The entire gulf of black life, that heritage of disrespect, stands between them for a moment.
Read the question back, he tells the court reporter, finally, without taking his eyes from Hardcore. It's my job to issue that instruction, but under the circumstances I do not intervene. Just nod to Suzanne. No money, nothing, Cor says. Ain't nothing like that.
Nothing like that, Hobie says. Standing over his notes at the podium, he takes a few more seconds to collect himself, shifts his shoulder, and rebuttons his handsome, green-toned Italian suit. Over in the jury box, in the journalistic dog pound, there is a steady murmur. Bribery. This case is too much. Something great each day. I see Dubinsky and Stuart Rosenberg huddled together, but turn away abruptly when I sense Seth trying to catch my eye.
Now, Hardcore, most of what you're saying about Niall, there's no kind of record of it, is there? Record? What kind of damn record, man? I ain't no DJ up here, man. Record. He huffs. No documents. Nothing to prove what you're saying is true. For instance, this phone call you say you made to Niall the morning of the murder after he beeped you. There's no record of that, is there? Not so far as you know.
The state has already stipulated to this. Hobie's on safe ground.
They's the money, man, says Cor. Right, says Hobie. The money. That's the only thing backing up your testimony, right?
Hobie's correct, but it's an argument, not a question, and I sustain the prosecutor's objection.
Well, haven't the prosecutors told you, Hardcore, how important that money is? Money be money, man. Make the world go round. I think that's love, Hobie says over his shoulder.
He's moving again, on the prowl, working his hands, his fancy alligator loafers scudding across the worn courtroom carpeting.
You understood that bag of money you delivered to the prosecutors. You knew it was the key to corroborating your testimony, didn't you? You couldn't have gotten your sweet deal without the money to back you up, right? Yo, man, chill. That wasn't no thing, man. 'Cause I had the damn money, okay?
Oh, you had money, says Hobie.
How much money, Hardcore, did you make every day slanging dope? $5,000?
Cor equivocates. He doesn't know.
2,000?
Hardcore shakes his head.
How many people did you say you had working for you? Did you say it was 5? Wasn't it more like 75? Oh, no, man. No, wait. You sky up.
I am. Let's talk about your cars, Cor. Hobie takes him through it all. Jewelry, houses, women he supports. Hobie has the police reports from the Force Narcotics Unit. Informant information and occasional surveillance. Cor is clearly spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Cor, you have $10,000 cash dope money sitting around any day of the week, don't you?
Ayers is sitting forward alertly now. Hardcore, sensing he's being trapped again, flares up.
Look, nigga, he give me the money, Jack, so just get behind it.
Hobie again comes to a complete halt. His eyes briefly flicker my way, which is all the invitation I need. Mr. Trent, the next time you address Mr. Tuttle in that manner, I'm going to hold you in contempt. Do you want to talk to Mr. Ayers?
That's all right, Judge.
Standing again, Jackson waves the back of his hand in a schoolmarmish way at his client.
You behave,
he says across the well of the courtroom. On the stand, Cor lowers his head and mutters to himself. I make out a few words. Buster man. It's Hobie whom he's referring to. A drag, he means. Hobie goes back to the prosecution table for People's Group Exhibit 1, the money, divided in two clear envelopes, and the plastic newspaper bag it supposedly was delivered in.
So it's your testimony that Niall Edgar gave you this bag and $10,000 in late August this year. They fingerprints, man.
Cor snidely smiles.
That didn't surprise you, did it? Ain't surprised, man, 'cause I knowed who dogged me the money. But you expected the money and the bag to have prints on it, didn't you?
Cor shrugs.
Maybe. Sure you did. You kept this money safe, didn't you? You didn't even take it out of the bag, did you? Isn't that what you said? Straight down. You didn't spend any of it, did you?
Nope.
You had other money to spend, right?
Right.
You didn't let this get mixed up with any of your other money, did you? Yo, you hear what I'm saying? That the money he give me, man.
Cor's been instructed by Ayers, by Tommy. The money's the case. He knows he can't come off it, not an inch.
You kept this bag secure because you knew if something went wrong, you'd have a way to give up Niall. That you'd have his prints. That you'd have this to hand over to the police, right? Isn't that how it was?
Hardcore considers the implications of the question at length. The weird yellowish fingernails recalling some Chinese mandarin appear as he scratches the incomplete goatee, and I see his eyes again drifting to Jackson. There's a trade-off here for Cor. By acknowledging these nasty calculations, he can explain why he had the cash to back up what he was saying. But in admitting he was prepared from the start to give up Niall, he's confirming the central tenet of the defense. Worse, perhaps, he's dissing his own character. The bangers, wild with the ravages of wounded ego, can rarely endure that. Yet across the courtroom, Jackson's chin drops no more than a quarter of an inch, and Hardcore gets it.
Could be, he says at last. Hobie tries not to look as if he was hurt by the response. Sure. You had that thought, didn't you? If I have this bag, if I have his prints, I have Niall. I'm always going to have something to give the laws if worse comes to worse.
He shrugs.
Yes? Is the answer yes?
Yes,
hisses Cor.
It isn't the case, is it, Hardcore, that you took this bag and a few bills that Niall had handled and put $10,000 of your dope money in here and made up this whole story, is it?
Cor's head rifles back. He snorts.
Get over yourself, man. Just get over it.
At the podium, Hobie evens his stack of notes and closes his folder. He rests an elbow there.
Now, Hardcore, I'm going to do something no good trial lawyer is supposed to do. I'm going to let you explain, all right, man? I'm going to be fairer to you than you've been to Niall.
In the moment of suspense, Molto fails to object to Hobie's rhetorical flourish. Purposefully, Hobie strides up to the witness box, holding the three exhibits, People's One, the blue bag, and the two packages of bills. Facing Cor, Hobie makes another long, melancholy inspection of him.
Now I want you to look at Judge Klonsky, and I want you to tell her why, if this is the $10,000 Niall Edgar gave you in August, if this is the money you kept safe, if this is the money you never took out of this bag, tell the judge Why, the West Side Forensic Laboratory says there's a high concentration of cocaine residue on nearly all of these bills.
Multo, Singh both erupt. Tommy screams,
"Oh my God!"
and is halfway to the bench before I even catch sight of him. He's bellowing,
"Objection, objection, objection, Judge! Judge, I'm supposed to get the results. You said, Judge, that the people were to get the lab results. I never got those results, Judge. What is this? What is this?"
I find I have my hand on my forehead again. Hobie has remained before the witness, holding out the second package, the one which he sent to the lab, but he has turned my way with a sheepish little boy face.
"Your Honor, I didn't know if I was going to use it."
"Judge, oh my God, Judge," yells Tommy. I point to Singh 10 feet behind Multo and suggest Rudy calm him.
"Mr. Tuttle, am I supposed to believe that? The discovery rules are clear, and my order was clearer."
"Judge Klonsky, they knew I was having the money tested. You allowed it."
"Judge," screams Tommy. "I asked him for the results. I was standing right there."
"And I told you," Hobie says, "no blood. You mentioned blood. They didn't find blood. You mentioned gunpowder. They didn't find gunpowder. That's what you asked."
"Oh, Mr. Tuttle," I say.
"What?"
he asks, as if he didn't know. Rudy, who's kept his wits, comes to the bench and moves to strike the question and exclude the lab results. I order a 10-minute recess and direct Hobie to turn over his lab report. Multo and Rudy are given permission to consult the witness. I broil a moment in rage. Lord, Hobie is a scoundrel. There are certain defense lawyers who become rogues with their clients, enjoying a commando existence, striking from the borderland beyond the rules. It's the one part of their job I knew I could never handle. What did Seth say about Hobie? He could have been more. Instead, he's just another courtroom tomcat. From the defense table where he's sorted through the banker's box to find the chemist's report, Hobie approaches the bench with my copy. I hold my head aloft, unafraid to convey my dim judgment of him. A musing, philosophical look crosses his features in reply. Nonetheless, I have to deal with the facts. In chambers, I study the lab report. 88 items of U.S. currency from People's Group Exhibit 1B, each identified by serial number, were examined first by washing, then by testing the residue with a mass spectrometer. Every item showed the presence of cocaine hydrochloride, with a residue on each bill weighing between 390 and 860 micrograms. No question, this is the result Hobie hoped for from the outset. It's why he wanted the bills tested. And he calculated well. The law, like everything else, plays its own game of ends and means. With warrantless searches, if dope is discovered, the courts always think of an exigent circumstance justifying the intrusion. And Hobie's excursion beyond the rules has also produced its own excuse. Hardcore lied. Hobie caught him. He proved it. No one, even these days, would exalt procedural regularity over a defendant's right to combat prosecution perjury. When the finger-wagging is over, I will not exclude the lab report. And when my anger subsides, I'll take in more fully what I already sense, that the state case, which hinges on the money, has been badly damaged. At a deeper level, I remain stuck on the question of motive. There's no reason Core on his own would want to kill loyal Edgar, or June, for that matter. It's likely Niall was involved somehow. But it may never be clearer than that. Hobie has taken a giant step toward raising a reasonable doubt. When we reassemble, Multo urgently renews the state's motion to exclude the lab report. Cocaine traces have rubbed off dope money onto most of the currency in the U.S. by now, he claims. That's true enough. But Hobie's chemist said the concentrations he identified were between 50 and 100 times incidental levels. I'll reserve ruling, I reply, until the report is offered in the defense case. Hobie plays his part, wailing in anguish as if he takes my threat seriously. Perhaps he does, but shamefaced groveling is part of the standard routine of the courtroom rascal. I offer the prosecution the chance to reopen their examination of Hardcore. They've had a few minutes together to account for the heavy cocaine residue on money Core claimed was never outside the plastic bag. But as Hobie anticipated, they have not been able to come up with much. Man, you know, says Hardcore when Tommy asks him to explain. Could be I had some shit in that drawer over by Doreen's. Besides, man, I can't be figuring what all Nile be doing when he kicking. Tommy nods, as if those responses were fully satisfactory, and concludes. Hobie stands at the defense table for a brief recross. You know, you make a urine drop when you come into the jail, don't you? Uh-huh. And do you know that Niles' drop was clean for cocaine? Objection sustained, but Hobie's point is made. Both lawyers say they have nothing further, and I call the luncheon recess. I stand on the bench, but on second thought motion to Suzanne, the court reporter, to remain. I want to say one thing, Mr. Tuttle, on the record. Any further violations of the rules of discovery, and there will be two consequences. I count off the warnings on my fingers. First, Mr. Molto won't even have to bother with a motion to exclude. I don't care if the Pope is here as a character witness for your client. If he hasn't been disclosed to the prosecution, his testimony won't be heard in this courtroom. And second, there will be severe sanctions for you personally. And I'm not kidding. Hobie's whole substantial upper body sways obediently. Yes, Your Honor, he repeats. I stare him down, even as he continues mumbling reassurances. What do we have next? I ask Molto. After lunch. He blinks, taken aback that in the confusion of the morning I've forgotten. The senator, he answers. Typically me, most feared is last remembered. In the meantime, the transport deputies in their brown uniforms have approached the witness stand to return Hardcore to the lockup. One of them, Giacetti, a large man with an unbarbered mass of gray hair, motions him down. Core rises to full height, and looming there, takes another instant to glower in the direction of the defense. Hobie catches him at it, and poised by the paper-strewn table, answers him with an unwavering, humorless look. It's not so much personal triumph Hobie communicates as a lesson, a declaration of faith. My way is better. Don't you see? It's better. The moment goes on. In the end, it's Hardcore, street-side master of a ruthless look of primal malevolence, who, with the excuse of the deputy's beckoning hand, turns away. Marietta's TV is held fast before her as I enter her office. The gray glow of her noontime soap is broadcast on her cheeks, but her eyes nonetheless veer toward me an instant. What? She does not bother with an answer, but hands me a small striped gift box with a note attached. Back at my desk, I open the envelope first. Sonny, thanks for dinner. I'd say more, but I don't want to break the rules. I thought Nikki might enjoy these things. I hope they'll hold her for the time being. Please tell her that meeting her was the nicest thing that's happened to me in weeks. I mean it. Seth. P.S. The cops found my father's car. It was parked around the corner. There was no damage, and the doors were locked. The cops interviewed a neighbor who knows my dad and said she saw him park in that spot 3 days ago. She's sure the car hasn't been moved. Apparently, he just got confused. I guess I'm going to have to do something. Seth. Like a blinkered pony, I've stifled an urge to glance at the jury box all morning. Even so, in this solitary environment, the thought of him forces up the warring feelings that have visited me occasionally for 2 days now, the adolescent zing of romance, and a stubborn dread verging on doom. Saturday night, I found myself numbed by the madness of being kissed. I sat in the living room in the pure white light of a long-armed halogen lamp attempting to read. Every 10 minutes or so, I found my fingertips on my lips, from which I promptly removed them. Inside the box Seth has dropped off, there's a large plastic tooth the size of an apple. It opens at the top, and within it are a number of dime store items, those wind-up teeth that chatter and bounce along the tabletop, and a crude set of false buck teeth, like the ones on which Jerry Lewis based a career. Nikki will be thrilled.
"Where'd that guy go to?"
she asked on Sunday morning, as if it made sense at all to think he might still be around. "He went home, silly. Did you like him?" The whole head moved, the dark bangs fluttering. She bit her lip and did not speak momentarily, attempting to cope with the reality that he'd left her behind.
"He should make a beard,"
she finally told me. "Maybe he should." I amuse myself with the thought of facial hair, last refuge of the balding. But sobriety returns quickly. I reach the same conclusion every time I think this through. Just let it go. That's adult life, isn't it? Small eruptions of insanity, and a regathering of forces for the long march of responsibility. Rereading Seth's note, I shake my head over his father. Then I repack Nikki's gift. I use the back door so I can avoid Marietta on my way out for lunch. All of us, Hobie and Seth and me, have been warped by time. Balder, fatter, altered in a way, but recognizable. The sight of loyal Edgar is shocking. I've seen photos in the paper on occasion, but they must have been taken more than a decade ago, when Edgar first struck out on his career in local politics. Not for a moment had it occurred to me that he is now in his late 60s. His hair, naturally, is shorter, thinned, and preponderantly gray. He has gained, over the years, 30 or 40 pounds, and his posture is reduced. Edgar, whom I never imagined softened, is softer. He stands before the bench now, waiting for instructions. His mere appearance is intensely dramatic. The father his son purportedly meant to kill. The reporters are on alert. The gallery again is SRO. Behind the bulletproof pane, the anxious, curious faces seem as remote as figures on TV. Back by the doors, Annie has stationed another sheriff's deputy to keep order, directing the standees left and right to make sure there is still an open lane for egress. Even Jackson Ayers has returned, his duty done, but his curiosity apparently high. He sits in one of the front row seats generally saved for representatives of the PA's office. Edgar stands on the worn grayish carpet at the foot of the bench, ill at ease as the focal point of lurid interest. A paper he has carried up with him is clutched in both hands. He is a smallish, stout man in a wool sport jacket. No one will be surprised when he answers that he was once a professor. He nods to me, in a brief lapse into familiarity. "Dr. Edgar," I say aloud. Marietta then cries out her, "Hear ye's," and I motion Edgar to the stand. He takes a seat and extends his face to the microphone. He smiles tentatively in my direction, as if he holds some hope for protection. He's ready. Administering the oath, I take note of the eyes. Still an astonishing blue. "I swear." He answers firmly and opens the button on his sport jacket when he sits again. "Mr. Malto," I say, "you may proceed." Tommy pouts when he stands. He does not look at his witness. The tone of the first few questions reconfirms my previous impression. Edgar and Tommy, both zealots at heart, do not care much for each other. They are formal with one another, which ironically makes the direct especially crisp. It lends Tommy an element of cool control, something ordinarily lacking in his presentation. How are you employed?
I am the elected representative from the 39th State Senatorial District.
Do you have any other employment?
I have an adjunct appointment as a professor of divinity at Easton University.
Edgar describes his district, which comprehends the campus environs at Easton and an area of public housing, one of the first scattered sites plunked down on the border of Kendall and Greenwood counties years ago on a former military base. He has been elected now to 7 consecutive 2-year terms and is the chair of the Senate Committee on Criminal Justice. Funding requests for police and prisons pass through his committee, as well as certain appointments in the Department of Corrections. 4 years ago, he won the nomination of the State Democratic Farmers and Union Party for state controller, but lost the general election. After quite a bit of this, we finally reached the first crescendo. "Sir," Malto asks, "are you acquainted with a defendant in this case, Mr. Niall Edgar?"
"I am."
"How do you know him?"
"He is my son."
Edgar does not make it through the answer. His composure, perfect to this point, vanishes as a quaver surrounds the last word. A sound, more hiccup than sob, erupts, though it may not be audible anywhere but up here on the bench. Edgar braces himself on the front rail of the witness box. The courtroom is still as we wait for him to recover. "Do you see your son here this morning?" Tommy asks, turning to Hobie. After Hobie's stunt this morning, the two are in the fullest throes of trial hatred, a state of mind fully akin to the one in which men at war shoot each other. Tommy wants Hobie to spare Edgar the discomfort of having to point out Niall for the record. Instead, Hobie pretends to be busy in the big white cardboard banker's box on the defense table and never looks Tommy's way. He murmurs something to Niall, though, and Niall once more props himself on the arms of his leather bucket chair and begins to rise. He could not look any guiltier if he tried. He cannot even bring his eyes toward his father. He stares directly at the oak baffles on the wall in front of him. Edgar attempts to lift his hand and instead covers his mouth. He begins to cry out loud. Throughout the courtroom, it feels as if no one can even breathe. "Record will reflect identification," I say coldly, gazing hard at Hobie. Has he lost his mind? How does this help? A man who misses nothing in the courtroom, he can probably tell you the level of the corner water cooler and how many steps from the lockup door to the witness stand. He continues feigning obliviousness while his client, visibly whitened, crumbles back into his seat at Hobie's side. On the stand, Edgar has his handkerchief out and pats his eyes. Tommy puts a few questions to him about Niall's upbringing, then changes subjects. "Do you know a man named Ordell Trent?" he asks.
"I do."
"How did you meet him?"
"I was introduced to him by Niall."
"And how did that take place?"
"I asked Niall to make the introduction."
"Can you explain why?"
"Objection."
"If it's a conversation with a defendant, I'll allow it. Is this something you told Niall, Dr. Edgar?"
"In various forms over the years, and we certainly discussed it after the meeting."
"Definitely." "Go ahead," I say.
"Basically, I believed that street gangs, like hardcores, have done something no one else has, namely, organize the poor community. And if that organization could be put to positive uses, particularly expressing the political will of the poor community, instead of the present unhappy ways those energies are employed, well, that would be a tremendous overall gain for everyone. The gang members, the poor community, and the city as a whole, which obviously would benefit in seeing a redirection of those efforts.
Speaking in his mannered way, his voice still slowed by southern cadences, Edgar seems to have scored over in the press box. His answer, carefully spun for public consumption, is being dutifully scribbled into a number of spiral-topped notebooks. Glancing over, I allow myself to look reluctantly at Seth. But for the first time since this trial started, I am beside the point. He is focused on Edgar, with an intensity suddenly reminiscent of the man I knew decades ago. Tommy moves on to the meeting between Hardcore, T-Rock, and Niall. Edgar has given the state a page from his daytimer, fixing the meeting at June 11, earlier than Hardcore seemed to recall it. In bare strokes, Edgar describes the irritation and disbelief T-Rock and Core showed for his proposal to turn the gang into a political organization. "How did you leave it?" Tommy asks. "That they would get back to me through Niall." "All right, sir," says Tommy. Rudy waves him to the prosecution table where he hands Malto a note. Tommy reads it, then leans down to his colleague. The two confer briefly, debating something, then Malto straightens up, drawing himself to full height in his frumpy suit. "During that meeting in T-Rock's limousine, sir, did T-Rock, or Hardcore, did either one of them offer you a bribe?"
"No," says Edgar.
Tommy turns to Hobie to preen, and is still faced that way when Edgar clears his throat and adds,
"They didn't actually offer me money."
Malto's head shoots around toward the witness. Then he looks down to Rudy's note and shoves it back crossly to his trial partner. The PAs were taking a chance, having apparently forgotten, during the frantic rush of the lunch hour, to go over this subject with Edgar when he arrived. Behind them, Hobie peeks up from his notes with a quick, cutthroat grin. Tommy begins again. "Calling your attention to the first week of September 1995, did you and Niall again have occasion to speak about Hardcore?"
"Yes, sir, we did."
"Can you tell us where you were?"
"We spoke by telephone. I was at my home in Greenwood."
"All right. And please tell us what was said and by whom."
"He merely told me that Core wanted to talk to me again."
"And how did you react?"
"I told him that was very good news, that I'd be pleased to meet him wherever he liked."
"And how were the time and place of the meeting set?"
"Well, as I recollect, I was taking the approach that I'd go anywhere, anytime. Core wanted to meet at Grace Street, and Niall suggested that the very early morning would be the wisest time for me to go down there."
"Niall suggested it."
"That's correct." Score for the prosecution. Niall set up Dad.
At the defense table, both Hobie and his client appear calm. Tommy travels along a bit, beneath the courtroom lights. In the same stoical tone he has maintained, he asks, "And who, sir, was June Edgar?"
"My wife." Edgar takes a beat. "My former wife."
Once again, he does not make it through his response and goes on, handkerchief in hand. Tommy politely sorts through the history of Edgar's relationship with June, separation in 1971, an amicable divorce in 1973, continuing contacts and friendship. June remarried in 1975 to William Chachos, a veterinarian in Marston, Wisconsin. That marriage ended in 1979. Thereafter, she periodically visited Greenwood County to help Edgar in his political campaigns. In 1980, when he ran for city council, in 1982, when he was elected mayor of Easton, and several times after that for his senatorial campaigns. Edgar answers quietly, ignoring the occasional tears as best he can. I find his inability to fully contain himself touching. 25 years ago, he was committed to accepting the inevitable harsh mechanics of history. I think what I never expected to. He's changed. And did Ms. Edgar visit you or Niall from time to time?
She did.
When did she visit Kendall County last?
He blows his nose and lifts his head to say she had come over Labor Day and had remained for a few days to shop in the city.
Had Mrs. Edgar remained involved in your political career?
Her home was in Wisconsin. She preferred the country, but I always depended on her advice. She was up to date with most of my activities.
Did you discuss this anticipated meeting with Hardcore?
Hobie objects, correctly, that the question calls for hearsay. Tommy moves then to the events of September 6 and 7, with Hobie making persistent hearsay objections, most of them well-founded. The reporters and onlookers seem baffled by the arcana of the rule, which allows a witness to testify about what someone said she would be doing in the future, but not what she said she'd done in the past. Edgar is allowed to say he was needed by his state senate office staff on the morning of September 7, but he may not relate his conversations with his staffers, nor may he testify that he asked June to meet Hardcore in his place. I do admit in evidence the note found in her purse in which she recorded Edgar's directions. Stained at the corner with a rusty brown I know to be blood, the slip of paper is handed up in its plastic jacket. There is a sloppy line drawing of the streets, and the words, Hardcore, Ordell Trent, 615, in a somewhat erratic hand. Finally, because a witness is allowed to testify about his own state of mind, I let Edgar explain why he asked June to meet with Hardcore, even though he can't relay his actual conversation with her.
I believed, says Edgar, that she would recognize the potential importance of the meeting with Core and would understand it was critical that someone see him personally.
And why was it critical?
I didn't want to insult him, Edgar answers. He rolls his lips into his mouth in a further effort at self-control.
And this meeting you had with Mrs. Edgar at about 5:30 the morning of September 7, was that the last time you saw her?
The last.
Tommy waits an appropriate interval to allow the solemnity of death again to fill the courtroom.
Now, on that day, on September 7, you were interviewed by Detective Lieutenant Montague. Do you recall that?
I do.
And, sir, Tommy puts his file down and folds his arms.
Were you fully candid with Lieutenant Montague when you spoke to him?
I was not.
And in what manner were you not fully candid?
Hobie objects.
Mr. Molto's impeaching his own witness, he says.
Lawyers in this country have been allowed to question the credibility of their own witnesses for 40 years now. Hobie is simply trying to break Molto's collected rhythm, and I point him to his seat.
He asked me, Edgar answers, if I knew why June had gone to Grace Street. And at first I told him I didn't know.
And why did you tell him that?
Hobie objects again.
Now he's rehabilitating his own witness.
Do you intend to cross on this subject, Mr. Tuttle?
Hobie averts his face, looking for a dodge he can't find.
Sure, he finally says.
Then you may as well hear the rehabilitation. Go ahead, Dr. Edgar.
I was very reluctant to disclose my political involvement with Hardcore. I realized it was likely to be controversial, and I didn't think it had any relationship to June's death.
I'm sure Molto and he have worked on this answer for some time, but it's a good one. Political self-preservation, Edgar is saying. He didn't want to be publicly allied with BSD. But no matter how artfully packaged, this is the first trace of the Edgar of old. He was instantly capable of a cold-hearted decision. June was dead anyway. Why soil his skirts?
Tommy walks along a moment, studying his shoes.
Senator, let me cover one final subject with you. I'm sure Mr. Tuttle will bring this out, sir, but I believe you have told the police that you don't know of any motive for your son to do you harm. Is that fair?
That's my view.
Tommy nods equably, as if this is all right with him. Senator, let me take you back to the meeting with the gang leaders and Niall in the limo. Had you informed your son that you were going to suggest this plan to T-Rock and Hardcore for BSD to become involved in politics? He claimed I hadn't. As I said, I've mentioned the subject to him often through the years, but I suppose he paid less attention than I imagined. He told you afterwards you took him by surprise?
Right.
And what was his emotional state as he told you this?
He was put out.
Do you recall what he said?
Edgar has stiffened slightly. Apparently, Tommy didn't give him a preview on this line of questioning.
I believe he said I was using Hardcore.
Did you and your son argue?
Niall and I have always had our moments. We had a somewhat heated exchange standing there on the street, and then within a day or two we both calmed down.
But he was very angry at the time?
At first.
At first, repeats Tommy. Hobie has ceased the note-taking and is watching Malto intently. Like Edgar, he has seemingly been taken unawares. Beside him, Niall has lowered his face to the defense table as he twiddles with a rubber band. It's impossible to know if he's even listening. Now, you told us, Senator, that Niall introduced you to Hardcore, correct?
Yes.
And whose idea was that?
Mine, I think. We were having one of these discussions about what Niall was doing. His work, how it was going, a father-son talk, I guess. And he mentioned this concern about Cannell's parole. And I said, Niall, well, why don't you have him talk to me? I might be able to help. Something like that.
And how did he respond to that suggestion?
I don't recall.
Did you bring up the subject again? Edgar looks to the ceiling.
I believe so.
So you had to suggest more than once that it would be a good idea for you to meet Hardcore.
Yes, I'm sure I did. I had this notion about the gangs that, well, I've testified to that.
Tommy takes a step closer. Did Niall talk to you about his work often?
All the time. As I said, the subject interested me.
Did Niall tell you he'd requested assignment to Grace Street cases?
Oh, yes.
Do you happen to remember, Senator, whether you suggested that assignment to him?
I might have.
Edgar nods serenely, but a certain calculating light has come over him. He's trying to recollect everything he may have unwisely admitted to Tommy in their many interviews.
I believe I did.
Now, his job as a probation officer, Senator, do you remember who suggested that line of work to Niall?
I'm sure I did.
You did?
Yes. Niall was at a point, well, he was like many younger folks. He was casting about, and I suggested it. I said, go on back to school and social work. You like all that.
And how long did it take him to do the schoolwork?
18 months, as I remember.
Did he do a thesis?
He did.
What was the subject?
Street gangs.
Malto looks at Edgar.
Yes, I suggested that to him, Edgar says.
And you helped him get his job, too, didn't you?
I made some calls.
Tommy assesses Edgar straight on. And can I ask, Senator, did you ever feel, sir, that Niall was undertaking these activities? School, the job, the assignment, arranging the meeting with Hardcore, in any way because he was pleased by your interest in him? As Edgar is deliberating, Hobie rumbles to his feet.
Your Honor, I'm sitting here just wondering whose side he's on anyway.
His hand, big as a paving stone, is directed at Tommy. Is that an objection, Mr. Tuttle? Hobie, of all people, is hoping to cue Edgar, who still seems to have little idea all this is coming at his expense.
I'd say it's an observation, Your Honor. My objection is that Senator Edgar can't testify to what the defendant felt.
Well, Mr. Tuttle, I'd say keep your observations to yourself. The question is what the senator believed, and I find the line of questioning directed at impeaching earlier testimony. Proceed, Mr. Malto. Edgar speaks enough of the lingo to catch the drift. Accustomed to being in charge, he swivels my way in the witness chair, looking both stumped and somewhat imperious. The question is read back.
I'm not sure I ever thought about it in those terms.
Tommy eyes him briefly before he nods in the same sage manner. Now let me see if I get this, Senator. Your son had spent more than 3.5 years following your suggestions about his education, his thesis, his job, his cases. And then, according to what he said to you, he suddenly found out as he sat in the back of that limousine that in everything you'd suggested to him, you had a political agenda of your own. Tommy utters this question in a placid tone. He might even be said to sound somewhat respectful, but everything else in his manner is stone cold. I see what's going on now. Malto is one of those gray men of the bureaucratic world whose whole life has been spent in service to the likes of Edgar, the savvy Pauls with the winning public manner and the unrestrained private appetite for glory. For such men, Tommy has risen and fallen, with few of them bothering to look back to him in the dust. And now he has the opportunity to call one to account. In what may be the most bizarre moment yet in an entirely unorthodox case, Tommy Malto, prosecutor for life, stands before the bar, advocating the defendant's point of view and lacerating the crime's intended victim with the professional calm of a surgeon. In his emotional funk, Edgar seems to be the last person in the room to recognize what has taken place.
Oh, please, he says suddenly, with a distinct echo of old-fashioned southern hauteur. Please, you are mixing apples and oranges. Niall was as interested in all of this as I was.
You said he became angry, very angry, after you left the limo.
Briefly, for a day or two.
He said someone was being used.
Hardcore, he said. He said Hardcore was being used.
Edgar shakes his shoulders to straighten his jacket.
You really don't see this clearly at all, he tells Malto.
I don't? Asks Tommy, and with that takes his seat.
May 4th, 1970. Seth. June and I spoke very little in the intervals between her calls to my father. Because my parents never vacationed, I had been in motels only 3 or 4 times before in my life, that is, if you did not count the U Inn back home, the site of innumerable bar mitzvahs and sweet 16s. I still experienced a childish thrill at the sight of the little free soap bars, the protective paper cap over the glasses, and the sanitary band on the toilet seat. Just for me. The odd environment of this tiny chamber and its purchased privacy seemed to heighten even more the peculiarity of what was occurring. Threadbare chenille spreads covered both beds. The floor was asbestos tile, while the dressers were strictly 1950s, with glass tops and a creamy lacquered finish. The owners, you could tell, still took some pride, but it would be swept away soon enough, and they would be renting by the hour. There was a narrow balcony, no more than a yard wide, with a single aluminum-framed beach chair overlooking the Alameda Freeway. June had brought along some fruit for lunch, and I sat out in the sun, eating my pear, watching the traffic race by, all these happy Californians on their way to who knows where. I decided that when I got to Canada, I was going to get drunk. I would have liked to score some dope, but that, of course, was out of the question. Misdemeanors of any kind, anything that could lead to deportation, were now to be dreaded. I sat there, abstractly, making plans I did not fully believe I'd ever carry out. We were in Damon's poorer neighborhood, the Black Patch, as Edgar would have it, abutting Oakland, and I surveyed all over again the diminished look of poverty. The military had come and gone in this part of town decades before, leaving a lot of unsound construction, light stucco buildings now seamed with tar. The stores on the commercial strip below compared dismally to what was only a mile or so east. They had painted signs above the doors rather than neon, and merchandise was sparse in their windows beside the fold-back grates. Watching the traffic, I noted for the thousandth time how black people still drove these terrible American cars, the big heaps meant to rust out and die within 5 years. Knowledge always comes hardest to the oppressed. That was what Edgar would say. In the glimpses between the crowded buildings, you could see the salt flats nearby, a terrain of marsh and mud beside the brackish waters of the bay. Seabirds still nested there, although you could see the network of white pipelines and tanks from the refineries a mile off in Richmond, smell their grotty effluvium on a wayward wind. Below us, a portly black man with a spirited walk went by. He was wearing a large cloche hat. I thought it was Hobie, and my heart unpredictably lifted. I actually stood to wave until I realized my mistake. "Do you think you can find out where Hobie Tuttle is?" I asked June. I stood on the threshold to the balcony. They had to have known, I realized, given the connections to Cleveland. "It'd mean a lot to me to see him before I go." June leveled a hand over her eyes to protect them from the afternoon sun. She was wearing a simple shirt-waist dress, meant to be unobtrusive. Two barrettes were in her light hair. She used a few fingers to motion me inside.
"We don't think you should be out on the street. You can never tell what happens if someone sees you. Control the random element," June repeated.
It must have been from one of their revolutionary manuals. Something said by Stalin or Jop, whoever it was they read on tactics. I knew better than to overtly quarrel with the notion of discipline. It was part of the revolution.
"Look, I'll be careful, real careful. Like I said, it would mean a lot."
She said she would see. I was encouraged that she didn't deny the possibility outright. She looked at me intently until I realized I was expected to return to the balcony before she would lift the phone to have whatever furtive, coded conversation she was going to undertake with whomever, Edgar or someone else. When I came back in later, she was sitting in the room's one straight-back chair, her feet propped on the bed as she read. The book she'd brought along was a hard-bound copy of Mr. Samler's Planet. Unlikely reading, I thought. But you could never tell with June. She had never fully renounced fashion. She told me she had no word yet regarding Hobie, then lifted her healthy arms, the book still in hand, and groaned a bit as she stretched. I had another sudden, forceful intimation which seemed to broil off June like heat from a sun-soaked stone, of how easy it would be for us, if we were only just a little different, to fill this time with sex. It could be abandoned, crazy, happy fun, a reminder that life only became complicated when the human population exceeded 2. I sat for quite some time, adjusting to the change of light. There was a single picture on the wall, turned to an angle of 10 degrees. A woodland scene, something restful for those who could not find slumber as the freeway thrummed. I wanted to read, too. The Gideon Bible was in a drawer of the crummy, chipped dresser.
I paged through Deuteronomy trying to find the words that had been in my mezuzah, as if they were a message in a bottle. I read, "Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the ordinances and judgments, the law I teach you, for to do them, that ye may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers giveth you."
Jehovah's line. It meant nothing to me. It was the rumble of the rhetoric, the weight of the words that seemed connected to the world of unchosen obligation and duty that I was seeking to shirk. "Patriarchy," I said. June smiled. She was the wife of a theologian. Around noon, June called my father back to describe the ransom plan. She instructed him to phone immediately one of the major casinos in Las Vegas, the Roman Coin, and to inform them that he wanted to open a betting line for his son in preparation for an upcoming trip. People did it all the time. He would fund the line with a wire from his bank direct to the casino.
"Tomorrow, Seth is going to the cashier there to draw the $20,000 in chips," June told him. "He'll have his driver's license for ID. Don't think about any heroes from the FBI rescuing him, because he's also going to have some plastique taped to his belly and a detonator on a remote control switch. Do you know what that is?"
"No," as my father answered, I was standing beside her, my head close to the telephone earpiece.
"It's a high-powered explosive," she said.
"Oh, my God."
"Very safe,"
said June, as my father said, "Oh, my God," again.
"Very stable, just as long as nobody hits the button, which they won't, because we are going to get the money, right?"
"Without question."
"Sure, without question."
I would mail the chips special delivery to a post office box in San Francisco. I was free to go at that point. Someone would then drive back and redeem them, not at the Roman Coin Casino in Las Vegas, but at the one in Lake Tahoe, as a precaution in case the chips had been marked in some way. Edgar, I was sure, had been on the verge of delirium in plotting all of this. It meant something that this whole scheme had flung him as far as possible from Maoist drab into worlds he never entered. Gambling, casinos. How did Edgar even know about such crap? How was it that he had absorbed so many of the rules and customs of the life he abjured? Envy, I decided, was a motive force of revolution.
"Now, when we get the money, Seth is free to go. He'll give you a call, only on one condition. He's on parole."
"Parole?"
"Right, parole. Like parole. Like he's okay if he's a good boy, see? See now, this whole thing is fucked up, right? We're thinking this guy's like the son of Rockefeller or something, and he's not. But we're not sitting in any pig slammer because we made a mistake and are dumb enough to say so. Do you understand me? We get covered for our expenses, bygones are bygones, blah, blah, blah. But not if it's us instead of him. Understand?"
"You wish to go free as well?"
"Exactly."
"This desire is not surprising," my father said.
"Irony, right?"
June asked.
"That's just what we want. No surprises. We don't want Seth here giving physical descriptions or making sketches. Or you opening up your mouth."
My father pondered. Static sizzled on the line. It was, I realized suddenly, a great match, Edgar against my father. At last he said,
I give you my word of honor that we shall disclose nothing.
Thanks. Well, that's great. That's out of sight.
No, I think we need to do a little better than that. Just a little.
She laughed meanly. She was, like any actor, in love with the part.
And don't treat me like I'm a fucking moron, because I'm not. Have I treated you like that?
He didn't answer.
See, we have a problem, and it gets worse. Because the way I get this, okay, your son was supposed to show up and get his ass drafted sometime today, last week, whenever. And he ain't there. And so the boys in the blue suits and shiny shoes are gonna be looking for him. You following?
I believe so.
He paused again to calculate.
Under the circumstances, I would think that Sess is no more eager than you to speak to the FBI.
Now you're getting close, mister. What's that thing about great minds? The only thing is, he plans to see the Northern Lights. Isn't that his gig? He's going to run away. And once he's up there, he won't be afraid to take a call from the Bureau. And neither will you. Now it's, hi, how are you? Let me tell you about these douchebags who ransomed my kid. So that's how come he's on parole. Remember parole?
Yes.
Okay. I'm talking fast because I'm running out of time. Don't want to break the rules. Here's the scoop. For the next 6 months, he goes where we say. We'll pick a place, somewhere in America the Beautiful, okay? Somewhere from sea to shining sea. Somewhere where we can watch him. He can live there. Work there, whatever he likes. We'll get him some papers, a social security card, that kind of thing. He can be underground. Just so long as he keeps in mind that we got a ton of people who can check on him. He knows just what we expect. He doesn't disappear, not for